C1S. Number 18B.
See, this sounds rather academical, but it's a vital point because it seems that most sciences fail on that point. Take, for instance, theology. Theology says, well, God is good and perfect, his creation is perfect, and man is a sinner. Man is fallen. Because they see if the conclusion would be right, namely that God makes everything perfect, that man is God's creation, then the conclusion would be that man is made perfect. But that contradicts the testimony of what they have before them. They only see man as a sinner. Therefore, they must find another reasoning, and they must find out somehow how a perfect man has fallen and has become imperfect, because they just don't want to stick to logical reasoning, to the syllogism of a right proposition. Most of the Christian Science textbook is really built on such syllogism. It always starts by a fundamental general statement, then a specific statement, and then draws conclusion. And thinking about science, we usually do that too. And only in this way we come to conclusion which may contradict on the first side to what seems to be right and reasonable. But if we take it as science and see that what is deduced logically from a principle must be right and must be harmonious, whatever the preconception is, and whatever it may look like to a standpoint outside. See, always in science, you see, always see that you never leave the standpoint, that you go out from mind and look at it as mind, and no more as a mortal, no more as a human being, no more from a mortal standard of things. The moment we draw a logical conclusion from a syllogism, and then when we have that conclusion which is right, leave the standpoint and look at it from a standpoint outside the principle, we lose the whole harmony of being. We lose it. So just see, the new sense of science is wholeness. Wholeness means that your four sides of the city must always reflect itself, and you must never leave them. So mind manifesting itself out of itself must be always mind manifesting itself through itself and not through something outside of itself. It's always manifesting itself as itself, never as something else. And it's always manifesting itself for itself and for the glory of itself and to itself. The foresight, and never for the glory of anything outside of itself, for the glory of a person, for the glory of this, or for the glory of that. And you will see that this gives you a tremendous certainty and freedom and assurance and joy, because you begin to realize that you are really living and moving and being in the one mind. Then it goes on to the fifth subject of life. I have epitomized it like this: science demonstrates ontology, or the science of real being, and overthrows all other systems which are antagonistic to true being. Well, the main point is that science demonstrates ontology. Ontology is the science of real being. This is can be contrasted to pantheism as the science of unreal being, It's the science of life in matter, pantheism, of intelligence in matter, substance in matter, soul in matter, of life in matter, of mind in matter, all that which takes, say, a synonymous terms and puts it into matter is pantheism, is the unreal science of ontology, and is antagonistic to true being. Ontology, a science of real being. See, having shown that principle as principle is always interpreting itself truly and as harmony, gives us naturally the real signs of being, real signs of life. But also it shows that principle is life. In ordinary science, in the old sense of science, we always have to apply a principle to something. Whereas in the science of being, we see that principle is life itself. Therefore, that principle applies itself. That principle is being, and therefore destroys the false sense of ontology. The sense of pantheism. It is therefore that principle which lies behind every evolution, because the theories of evolution looked at seems to be pantheism, the development of life in matter, the development of the first little cell up to conscious man. Whereas really, as she says here, we have to look deeply into realism in order to understand ontology. We begin to see that which shows itself as a pantheistic evolution isn't at all a pantheistic evolution. It is the divine principle of life that was always at work through billions of years to force matter to disappear, to force matter to give up its rigidity, its staleness, its inactivity, and give it up in order to make place for the individuality and infinity of life. So evolution, looked at as an evolutionist theory, seems to be pantheistic. Looked at from the divine principle, the theory of evolution is not at all pantheism. It's ontology. It's the genesis of life in its true sense, by making the rigidity, the narrowness, the limitlessness of matter disappear, which shows itself as an ever-growing and unfolding sense of life, from the first little cell up to conscious man with ideals and with consciousness. It's therefore quite interesting to see what she says here, that she says, here on line 12, on 129, a belief which science overthrows. In those days there will be a great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world. Evolution is that. It was a great tribulation, because matter doesn't want to give up its claims, but had to give up its claims under the impulsion of life. And then she goes on and says, and earth will echo the cry, art thou truth come hither to torment us before the time. That's always what we experience. So often we cry out that it is before the time, that something is happening and tormenting us, forcing us really to evolve. We experience it as tormenting, as something happening which we feel is a catastrophe, is a crisis, I don't know what. But behind it is ontology. There is never anything going on but the divine principle which says, I am life. And I can't give you to anybody more than just life. But if you don't accept it because you say you come too early to life, and I don't want to progress and I don't want to change, then it torments. And the whole evolution which we see from the first cell up to man was one big tormentation, a whole races coming and going, a whole species coming and going, floods coming and going, whole vegetations coming and going. It was one great tormentation. That's my word. See, one big crisis in evolution, but the same is true with us. Why do we go through crisis? Why do we go through torments? See, why do we do that? Because we don't want to change. Because we don't want to yield to the activity of life. We try to hold on to pantheism, that which we have in our body and in our life and in our setup, in our career, in our business, in our everything, we want to keep that as it is. Whereas if we look deeply into these things, we find life, the life power, forcing itself on us, on each one of us. Because principle as life says, I want you to make great. I want you to make you big. I want to make you the holy of holies, the anointed. So in order to become that, you have to give up something. You have to give up the faults. And then we cry, art thou already come? Can't you wait a little bit? I'm not ready. I'm all right to give up something when I'm ready for it. And so she ends that tone of life with a great sense of being willing to accept what life is asking us, to object and not to reject, not to object, not to be reluctant, not to be an unwilling guest and so on, but that we come and accept that we don't have a farm and other merchandise and therefore they cannot accept. It's the great sense of life which says to us, accept. And then we have, then science melts over into ontology. In the tone of principle as truth, to which we come now, it is said, as I epitomized it, as there is no error in science, the actuality of science demonstrates harmony with the divine principle of all being by destroying all discord. Now, naturally you see that as a necessary outcome of what we have been seeing before, that if principle is life itself, and therefore principle applies itself, if principle really is principle and practice, that principle is forcing everything which has a false sense of life to give way to the true ontology, then naturally it must destroy all false sense. So the new sense of science which we have here again is this, that truth applies itself and demonstrates itself. Ordinary sciences have to be demonstrated. They can't do anything except we demonstrate them, we apply them. But truth is the Christ, and that's the difference between physical science and divine science, that truth has its own Christ, and so works by itself, and works by itself in destroying everything that is unlike itself. She shows here that because science is destroying all discord, we really should be much more astounded at error. That we should just take again a different view and change our consciousness, because usually we feel that if something happens wonderfully, it is a wonder. And if something good is happening, we are very joyful and very glad and feel, oh, how wonderful this is and what a big demonstration I have made. Whereas the wonderful and the big demonstration is the nature of truth, which should be natural and the rule. And we really should become, or really should be, what she says, astounded at the vigorous claims of evil. The whole paragraph then goes on and shows how we really should much more doubt evil than good, that we should not regard it as natural to love sin and unnatural to forsake it. It's a complete overturning that takes place here, that really we should only, so to say, have time to be astounded at evil and not when something wonderful happens. That should be the rule, the general rule, the most natural thing, and that we should be really flabbergasted when something goes wrong and not be quite astounded when something goes wonderful. So he says that the facts of truth should not be doubted, or should not really be, the thought should not be startled at the workings of truth. Again, a change of consciousness, so that we really expect the good, always expect the good, always find it quite natural that only the maximum of good is developing and unfolding and manifesting itself. If we have in consciousness that sense, oh, if only a wonder would happen, and oh, if only something big would happen, and so on, we doubt truth. We have already the seed within ourselves which is unscientific, because we go out from the belief that it is quite an exception if truth works something out in a marvelous way. So we are in that mood, we really expect evil to happen and are quite astounded when it doesn't happen. Then we come to the last tone of love, a very short last paragraph, which I have summarized in saying, in science, through the superiority of spiritual power over physical power, it's really the superiority of divine science over physical science, the false testimony of the corporeal senses disappear, so that even the testimony of evil disappears. Sometimes I feel these last two subtones of truth and love have something similar to Habakkuk and Zephaniah. They come one after the other in the prophets. That in the prophet Habakkuk, he also begins to see the naturalness of truth and the superiority of truth. Though, to physical sense, to corporeal sense, he can only behold error. Whereas the next prophet, Zephaniah, sees that even the testimony of the physical senses yield to the spiritual sense. It is as if first the evidence before the physical senses has to be set right, and when that has been set right in spite of everything, that then in Zephaniah we have the disappearance of the physical testimony. She says, when once destroyed here by divine science, the false evidence before the corporeal senses disappear. Before it was just gaining the spiritual evidence through divine science. But now, that is really Habakkuk. Remember Habakkuk, how he only sees first that the divine law is powerless. Then he sees that those who do evil are much more successful than the others. Then he sees that God doesn't care a bit about people, that he doesn't protect them, protect Israel and so on. And then he says, oh, I go on my watchtower. And he changes his standpoint and goes to principle. And from that standpoint, he begins to see in life that the earth is full of the glory of God as the water covers the sea. And then he sees that God is really having dominion over the whole earth. And then in the last tone of love, he is very confident that this will be so in spite that he sees the very opposite. You see, Habakkuk doesn't end by showing that the problem is solved. He ends by seeing, although he says that the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be on the vine, the labor of the olive shall fail, the field shall yield no meat, the flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls. Although he sees that, he says, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. Just as in the tone before of principle as truth, he said, I really should be astonished at evil. I rejoice though I see evil. But then in Zephaniah, he gives the answer, he gives the solution to the problem. There, all is cut away. The whole prophecy is cutting away, putting off, is rooted out, to destroy, to despoil all evil. And then at the end, he rejoices because he sees only good. He ends quite differently than Habakkuk. He says, sing, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel, be glad and rejoice, and so on. The Lord has taken away thy judgment. He has cast out thine enemies. You see, he has solved the problem. Habakkuk hasn't. But Habakkuk had to go before, because he had first to establish the spiritual evidence in spite of the physical in spite that physical senses testify to the contrary yet. See? But in Zephaniah, the whole testimony of the physical senses is destroyed too. It's not just spiritual evidence, it's also physical evidence of bounty. The Lord has taken away thy judgment. He has cast out thine enemies. Thou shalt not see evil anymore. The Lord thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. I will undo all that afflicts thee. Can you see how the spiritual development goes? That in truth we just see that truth has dominion. But in love we see that any sense of opposition, any sense of disharmony is wiped out. So she ends that the central fact of the Bible is the superiority of spiritual power over physical power. Well, that's how she ends that whole section on science. We have seen in this last tone of principle how she has developed the subject. The subject is that we have to exchange a human concept of science for a divine concept of science. What is a divine concept of science? In the subtone of mind, she has said, the divine concept of science is that we go out from the one mind as a source of revelation, the source of power, the source of every true knowledge. And therefore we have to change the human mind and take the standpoint of the divine mind. In the second subtone, she said, therefore, if all is divine mind, nothing is matter, then there cannot be material science. If all is mind, and therefore spiritual, there cannot be any physical science. But that does not mean that you are up in the clouds, because soul translates the spiritual to every plane of thought. So in the subtone of soul, she shows that divine sense of science includes humanity by giving to humanity a better sense of being. Then in the tone of principle shows that it says, so don't be afraid, stick to your principle, don't deviate from the principle. If you have stated If you have gone out from the right point of the true syllogism, then whatever the conclusion is, it is right, it is harmonious. Don't waver, even if it is contrary to your preconception. Because, as life says, it will work. It is life. It will work and will be tribulation, but its purpose is to bring out ontology, the science of life, that which is giving you a new sense of life, life in spirit, and not pantheism, life in matter. And in the next subtone shows, therefore, this life principle is truth, and with that truth, truth is the natural. So don't think that evil is good is unnatural. And this truth is destroying error to the point of love, where nothing is left over of a false evidence before the corporeal senses, and the thing is solved. Yes, well, that's the tone of principle. Naturally, when one goes through the text, it's a bit tiresome sometimes, but it all is here really to find out the pith of a subject. And the pith of a subject here in this chapter impresses me enormously, as practically no other chapter. But perhaps I say the same thing in the next chapter. But really, through this winter, it has awoken a new sense of science. And thinking over what she says up to now, you see, we can lift it up in the metaphysical level. She says, I have discovered a new science. What new science? She says, I have discovered the laws of life, truth, and love. That's the plane of absolute Christian science. Have you asked yourself, what are the laws of life, truth, and love? What could they be? What is the law of life? The law of life is spontaneity. It's not causality. The law of life is the law of newness, not of amelioration and improvement. The law of life is that newness is that progression and not progress. It's not progressing step by step. In being, you see, one has found out in science that there is not such a thing as progress as one thought it was. That the whole world has progressed step by step, little by little, out of itself. But that every progress that has been made was not really something developing from the all, but always a newness, a mutation, as they say, a spontaneous new creation of something, and not the development out of the old. So life is that sense, you see, the laws of life is that sense which says, There is a principle called life which says, I can do every moment something absolutely new, independent of what has gone before. Think of what that would be for our life. We always think we have been doing this and this and this, and have been doing this for so many years, and have been good so many years, and bad so many years, so we have to have the results now. No! The law of life in absolute Christian science says, life is spontaneous, it doesn't take into consideration whatever has ever gone before. It is spontaneous, it's new, it's split-second newness. It's the law of life is self-supporting. It isn't that which grows out of the past into the future. Never. Life is now, newness of nouns. It's multiplication and not addition. We always have a sense of addition. We add not only our years, but we add our efforts, we add our knowledge, we add our energies, and we add our things and that and the other. But that's not the law of life. The law of life says, be open, be receptive for the influx of the whole. That's law of life. What is the law of truth? The law of truth is not that we apply truth, that we demonstrate truth. But the law of truth is that truth demonstrates itself, that truth applies itself, that truth self-realizes itself. It's a self-realization of truth, the self-revelation of truth. That's the law of truth. It's not so much what we do with truth, how we use truth, but it's how truth uses itself. We never get out, we should never leave the withinness of a synonym. To go out from a synonym, rest within the synonym, come back within the synonym. Or what is the law of love? The law of love is not really gaining something, gaining fulfillment, is not really the law of achievement, but the law of love is self-fulfillment, is the law of oneness, of wholeness, the law of unity, really, wherein everything is right from the beginning mapped out, designed out, planned out, so that there is no need for addition. And so if we keep these three laws in consciousness and see, that may be what she discovered, the law in Absolute Christian Science, the law of life, truth and love, the law of spontaneity, of fullness, the law of self-realization of that fullness, the law of wholeness within that fullness, and see that that is what she discovered. And then she says, and I saw that this is Immanuel, that is, that this law of life, truth and love is one with me, is me, God with me. And what does she say afterwards, what this law of life, truth and love have revealed? Then she shows the seven subjects of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth and love, so that we can see, if I leave all the little bits aside and just epitomize it in the terms of our synonymous terms, I begin to realize that the science which he has given is that the eternal Trinity, the eternal person, divine person of life, truth and love, acts as the law of spontaneity, of self-realization and self-fulfillment every moment as my mind, as my spirit, as my soul, as my principle, as my life, as my truth. That's my love. You see, that's quite different in thinking, perhaps, than if we just have the seven synonymous terms and in our practice or in our quiet moments think about that mind is my mind, that spirit, God, is my spirit. It's much bigger when I see, but behind that is the impulsion of the law of life, the law of spontaneity of life, the law of truth, of self-realization of the truth, and the law of love as a self-fulfillment of love, which is my mind, which is my thinking, which is my consciousness. So that life, the law of life, truth and love, really is my mind. That life, truth and love has a mind, is mine. That life, truth and love is the mind of me. Then I have, then can you feel? Then you don't have the feeling you have to think about mind to make it work. That's metaphysics. But when you come to science, you feel life, truth, and love as the law of life, truth, and love is my thinking, is my mind, is my activity, is my power, is my force, is my law. That life, truth, and love is my spirit, is my way of unfoldment. That life, truth, and love is the enforcement of my unfoldment, is the impulsion behind my unfoldment. That life, truth, and love is my soul. Therefore, that life, truth, and love is my identity, is my mission. It is not so much showing my mission, but it is my mission, because it's absolutely identified with life, truth, and love. So I get a wonderful sense that if I sleep or dream or are awake, if I think of it or not think of it, the principle, which is the law of life, truth, and love, is at work as my soul, is therefore at work as my destiny, as my mission, as my identity, as my name. It's life, truth, and love is my principle. Not only principle is my principle, it's a higher sense, can you feel? A more powerful sense, so to say, if you translate absolute Christian science to the plane of Christian science and see, oh, the Trinity, the Holy Person, the One Person, Divine Person, which is life, truth, and love out of itself, is my principle. Therefore, it's my governing principle. Life, truth, and love governs every part of my body, governs every part of my mentality, governs every part of my spirituality, governs every detail in my life, governs every detail in my consciousness, governs my plane, my design. It's life, truth, and love who does it, not my thinking, not my working about it, not my doing the dailies. It's she discovered, you see, she discovered first, I think, divine science, and it came to her as absolute Christian science, as the laws of life, truth, and love. And then she had to see that it was Immanuel, my, our mind, our spirit, our soul, our principle. That life, truth, and love is our life. See, we like to think about life and say, oh, it's wonderful. Our life is God. God is our life. Yes, that's wonderful. But somehow it gives a higher power or a higher dynamic if one begins to realize that not God is my life, but life, truth, and love as the law of spontaneity, as the law of self-realization, as the law of self-fulfillment is my life. What other life can I live but the life that is impelled by life, truth, and love? That life, truth, and love is my truth. That therefore life, truth, and love is the forming standard of my manhood. That life, truth, and love is, say, the forming standard of my consciousness. It's quite different than to think, oh, I have to put my thoughts aright. I have to put my consciousness straight. How different it is when I go right from the standpoint of absolute Christian science and say, well, everything that is ever at work is really only life, truth, and love. They are at work. Not my thoughts are at work. I can't make life, truth, and love work. So life, truth, and love are at work at what? As what? As my consciousness. As that which forms my consciousness, as the forming standard of my consciousness, as the forming Christhood of my being. Or I can see that life, truth, and love is really my love. That I have not a love of my own, that I don't have to see how can I love and be loving, but that life, God, truth, God, love, God, are a law to themselves. They are forever active. Omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, active, as my love, therefore as my design, as my plan, as my fulfillment, as my purpose of life, as my aim of life, as my design. And I think that's, in a nutshell, what this chapter wants to say. That the new sense of science, which is absolute Christian science, is precipitating itself, so to say, on the plane of Christian science as healing. We saw that it was the divine science of mind healing. Therefore, it starts first by seeing that life, truth and love is my mind, my spirit, my soul, my principle, my life, my truth, my love. And then naturally, afterwards, one begins to see that because life, truth and love is my mind, it dissolves the concept of having a mind of my own. Because life, truth and love is my spirit, it dissolves the belief of having a material consciousness and a material view of things. And so it begins to dissolve the false concept of mind, the false concept of spirit, the false concept of soul and principle and life and truth and love. And is so translated to the plane of Christian science. But who does the work? The law of life, truth and love. What have I to do about it? I, as a small I, as a personal ego, nothing at all, except, I would say, to let it happen. To have that which says, I'm receptive. I open myself completely to the working of this law. And the wider and the bigger I open myself and be conceptive and accept it and let it unfold and let it develop, the bigger, the mightier, the stronger, with more impulsion, with more power, this life, truth and love will be my mind, my spirit, my soul, my principle, my life, my truth and my love. All right, tomorrow we go on.